Hello and welcome to the Business of Data podcast. My name is Catherine King and I'll be your host. In this podcast, we chat to senior executives from a range of departments, industries and functions, all about their passions, experiences and challenges within data analytics. Let's go ahead and dive straight into today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Business of Data podcast brought to you by Corinium. This week, we are talking all about how the sky is the limit, insights from the US Space Force. And to do just that, I think it's only right that I am joined by Mark Brady, who's the Chief Data Officer for the US Space Force. Now, if you have yet to meet Mark, just a few intro facts to get you up to speed. Mark joined the US Space Force as CDO in December 2020. And prior to this, has worked within a number of governmental organizations, such as the Air Force, the US Department of Justice, and NOAA as well. Now, if you can't find Mark at his work desk, you'll most likely find him in the great outdoors, tackling mountains or practicing for a shooting competition. Mark, it's great to see you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Catherine.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me. And I've got to ask straight away, shooting competitions sound really exciting. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I got interested in marksmanship while training with the Marines and right away found it to be an interesting mental exercise, almost like meditation. Since then, both the military and the competitive shooting sports have evolved to simulate more realistic scenarios with courses you run through and unpredictable targets. It's less like meditation now, and more like controlled chaos. And it's interesting that although I've been out of the Marine Corps for a long time, things have come full circle and that I currently train on the local Marine Corps base.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, my my fiance does short bore rifle competitions, and I had a go at a range a few months back, and I just forgot to breathe. I was concentrating too much until the instructor was like, "Catherine, now breathe," because I was going so red in the face trying to do it all.
You have to be very careful.
But I love that. And I love, I always like to ask these questions of what people are passionate about outside of work. Because I do think it influences your approach to work and leadership and, you know, doing all those various obstacles and trials and everything and, you know, really keeping focus in competitions, I'm sure translates into your work life. And going from that, I mean, your journey into the US Space Force seems somewhat natural from the other organizations that I listed in the introduction and in your background in service as well. Did it feel for you as natural as it sounds on paper as you transitioned into these different roles?
Well, it did in a way. I mean, it's not supposed to be natural to get into all these different subject matters, but the interesting thing about that is that data is the same everywhere. So it isn't really the subject matter at all. And it's definitely been a journey. Before getting focused on data, I was doing AI research and teaching neuroscience and statistics. And since we're still doing AI as part of data management, the AI and the neuroscience experience has been very useful. But my first purely data job was as an analyst for the National Marine Fisheries Service, tracking the commercial fishing activity in the North Atlantic. And they were facing a number of challenges at that time. And right away, I started seeing solutions to those problems and knew that the field was wide open for progress. And it was an area that I'd be able to contribute.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So from there, I went on to become information architect for marine fisheries in their 6 science centers, regional offices, as well as a number of laboratories. Marine fisheries, by the way, is the O in NOAA, which is the NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So in addition to establishing NOAA fisheries for strategy, then there was also the opportunity to help the larger NOAA develop their data strategy. And that NOAA work included setting up an ocean acoustics archive, as well as being part of their big data partnership. What that was a project where NOAA's enormous data collection was made available for commercialization. They wanted to take this government asset and stimulate the economy. And we partnered with the tech giants in order to do that, such as Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and IBM. And things also branched out from there internationally. The United Nations was looking for a U.S. delegate to help develop electronic trade standards. And that was a great project to be a part of as well. So during the big data partnership, I met with the NOAA chief technology officer. And soon after, he and the NOAA CIO were recruited by the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice is a large organization. It has 113,000 employees. It includes the FBI, U.S. Marshals, Drug Enforcement Agency, civil and criminal U.S. attorneys, just to name a few. That was interesting, just thinking about the great complexity of all of that. And the CTIO invited me to join him at Justice and establish their first data strategy there, which I did. Another opportunity that came up while at Justice was to join the White House data cabinet and get to see what all of the other departments within the U.S. government were doing. So, that as well. So then the next topic was space. And this was back in 2018, prior to the establishment of the Space Force. There was no Space Force at that time, and space was scattered among the different military services, and the largest of which was Air Force Space Command. So I interviewed with the first Department of the Air Force, CDO, and former at that time, she had joined Air Force Space Command and was hired as their first CDO. And so that's how I got into space. And then when the Space Force was set up in 2020, then they asked me to become their CDO. And so that's where I'm at now.
Yeah, amazing. And just because we do have a global listenership here, Mark, just give a little bit of a tease as to what Space Force really covers, because I think there's quite a stereotypical view of what some of us will think Space Force is and then what it actually is. And I think it'd be good if you just dispel all the mysteries and just kind of give a focus on what you guys are really thinking about over there.
Yeah. So when I first discussed this with my niece, and told her what it was, she was rather shocked. When I told her that we do space war fighting, she was envisioning that we were up there as astronauts or something, shooting at each other. And that's not exactly what we do. We operate by remote control. And so if you think about the natural evolution of military departments and services, there was first the Army, then the Navy, and then there was the Air Force. But the Air Force originally was part of the Army. And all these things are different physical domains. And so as we started to develop military satellites and commercial satellites, which are vital to commerce and the basic function of life today, then we have a new domain and we naturally expanded out into that. And it's the new high ground.
Amazing. Amazing. So for you, Mark, as you look around your team, your organization and your sector, what would you say are the biggest challenges that you're facing at the moment?
I think the biggest challenges are data access and what we call observability. So access is something where obviously certain data, especially with all the cyber security issues that we see today, you want to make sure that the data doesn't get into the wrong hands. But at the same time, there's the matter of underutilization. So if the folks that are trying to execute a mission don't have all of the data that they need, then that can be even a greater or at least an equal risk to the cybersecurity risk. And I think that's largely underappreciated. The other is observability. So as things get more and more complicated in terms of our data and data systems, it gets to the point where an organization might not even know what data they have. And if they are able to get that far, then they may not understand all of the data. And then there's the matter of the complexity of the data systems. These things tend to evolve individually from each other. And you get to a point where you have to very deliberately start tracking what data is flowing from one place to another. Mm. So that's the observability thing that we're working right now.
Yeah. Such an interesting challenge that you're facing, and something certainly I've heard across the sector, both from the access point of view, as you say, with the security piece and the privacy piece as well. But then the observability, I think it's really interesting for me that I don't think you can name another asset in a company where organizations don't have a tighter understanding of what's going on. Yet when we talk data, there's still quite a misconception of where it is, who owns it, how does it look, what quality is it? And it's surprising that we're still not quite there yet for many organizations and sectors for that.
Yeah, things are still in their infancy, I think, in this field.
Yeah, sure. Now, when we caught up before, Mark, you said something really insightful that I wanted to bring into this conversation, that when it comes to data, having a culture of sharing rather than control can be a big factor in adoption. How are you currently battling through that? Because it feels like a bit of a cultural shift from control into sharing.
Well, for a long time, employees have felt that if they know something that other people don't know, that that's some kind of a job security. And that's ingrained in our technical culture, has been for a long time. And so what we need to do is we need to get away from data ownership and get towards data stewardship, because the way that we should evaluate our employees recognize their value is in terms of how much are they sharing the data, mm-hmm. rather than how much do they own it. And so that's the cultural challenge. Really, cultural change is a greater challenge for CDOs than the technology. If you know what you're doing, the technology is relatively straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely. It does tend to be on these conversations I have, Mark, that it's the people that hold the linchpin of everything else. And that actual fact, I know that you've spoken extensively on when it comes to kind of building strategies with data and the data capabilities. You've built up a bit of an idea around this kind of universe of strategies. Is that right?
Well, the part of communicating the value of data and sharing data to the organization is seeing how it ties to your mission. Mm-hmm. And the way that it ties to your mission is based on what I call the five strategic factors. And those strategic factors are what you have, which are your physical assets, including your personnel, what you know, which seems pretty obvious, but really turns out not to be, what your competition has, what your competition knows, and the environment. And those five things completely determine your strategic universe. And in any organization, whether it's a business or whether it's a military organization, your objective is to win. And in most cases, win in some sort of competition. And so we need to communicate what that connection is. And what we can do with data isn't so much the strategizing, which is the business of a strategist, of course, and is important. But we can actually manipulate that strategic universe, which is determined by the five factors. And that's really what our job is. And although there's things in there that aren't data, and they're super important too, one of the things that is especially interesting about the data is that it has relationships with the other factors. Like, if you don't know everything that you have, what condition is it in? What can it do? Where is it? Then the what you have isn't as usable towards your success as well. And then likewise for your competition, what do you know about what your competition has? What do you know about what your competition knows, and all those things. So data is super important, but it's not having the data and data itself isn't the last word, because it turns out that there's different levels of knowing. And if you just have the data and you don't know that you have the data and you don't understand the data. Mm-hmm. So there's actually four levels of knowing. And to be really successful, you need to be at the highest level of knowing and not at the introductory level.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the language you use around kind of the mission part to this. Now, obviously, I know from the background you're speaking in, it kind of comes natural to have these sorts of languages. But I think there's certainly no harm in any sector, any organization, having that mission be so clear that you know where you're moving the needle and kind of the aim of the organization's given campaign, etc., so that you know how you're going to be influencing that strategy for sure.
That's right. Now, we all have a mission.
Yes. At least we should all have a mission. And it's about communicating that, right?
Yeah.
I think we've had such a turbulent time over the last few years. And just, you know, if you turn on the news now, it's still turbulent. I think actually making sure that everyone's on the same mission is sometimes mm-hmm. half of the battle, in a sense of making sure that, we're all working towards the same goals at the same time, at the same pace, for the same reasons, can be half the challenge.
Yeah, it's easy to forget.
Yeah, for sure. Now, Mark, I couldn't help it, but call this episode "The Sky's the Limit." But I do stand by that. I think the possibilities mm-hmm. when it comes to data are endless. And I know, obviously, as you mentioned in the start there, your interest in AI came from your academic background, or rather STEM there. And I know it's still very much part and parcel of what you're interested in today. And I think when it comes to AI, I truly believe that the possibilities are endless. What's your thought on AI at present? You know, you've been in this space for so long. What's your thoughts on where we are with AI and where we're going?
Well, there's a lot of excitement around AI right now. That sort of thing kind of comes in waves because it's very challenging. And at times we have in the past anyway thought, hey, we don't need to fund this for a while because we're not making any progress,
yeah.
Which is why I became interested in neuroscience, actually, to find some new ideas there. But the state of the art is such that machines are still thinking very differently from the way humans think. And the reason for that is because humans actually rely on intuition to a large extent. And so in AI, we start out trying to make computers and succeeding in making computers process logic and doing calculations, which they do very well. In fact, they do it better than humans do it. So in that regard, computers are superior to humans, and they're superior in terms of their memory.
Mm.
But their memory is different from human memory, not only in its infallibility, but in that human memory is associative. So humans remember things in the context of other things. You have a framework where you encodes new memories. If it doesn't mean anything, then it's hard to memorize. Whereas a computer, it doesn't matter whether it means anything or not. And so it's that associative thing as well as experience in the physical world, which allows humans to think in what I call an analogical way. So you can learn one thing, have one skill and ability, and then transfer it to something completely new. That's what gives us our autonomy, which we're trying to instill in computers right now.
Yeah. And for you, what are the sorts of applications that you're excited about with AI in terms of the Space Force?
Well, there's just so much going on in space, and of course we interact with the other domains as well. So much going on there. And there simply aren't enough people to keep track of all that. And so we need machines that have human-like capabilities where they would be able to do some of the things that humans do, although they'll make different sorts of mistakes that we do, and vice versa. We complement each other in a way. Mm. And so you can retain what we call space domain awareness much more broadly by applying artificial intelligence.
Fantastic. Now, what do you think the future of AI looks like from all your experience, both academic and professional in your various roles? What are you looking forward to in the future, or rather just looking at in the future predictions?
Well, we've been hearing from such luminaries as Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking about the dangers of AI potentially. And we also hear from others of the great potential to save humanity from various challenges. And I think it's really more nuanced than that, because it isn't inevitable in either case. The threat of AI isn't AI itself. It's really what you call the objective function, or what I would call the objective function, and AI researchers use that term. So what that means is that an AI entity has an objective. It's a thing that it's trying to do, kind of like human emotion. In fact, it would be the equivalent for machine. And so that's the thing that you really need to keep track of. What we do with current AI, and have been doing for a while actually, is machine learning, which is a subset of artificial intelligence. And that's a kind of adaptation. So you want the AI to adapt, you want it to learn, but the one thing that you don't want it to ever adapt is its objective function. Mm-hmm. You need to set that and you need to control it. And if we can do that successfully, then AI will be an asset and it won't be a threat. Now, having said that, you know for certain, and I can guarantee that somebody somewhere is going to break that rule, and establishing any laws to the contrary is not going to have any long-term impact. Somebody's going to break the rule. And so then what do you do? Well, then you need defensive AI to counteract the dangerous AI. And so I think that is the way forward to maintain AI as an asset that we can live with in the future and in the far future.
Mm. No, and going on from this, I know when we've caught up before, you've mentioned that you've been thinking a lot about the singularity. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that relates to what I was saying about intuition. So in order for machines to think the way that humans do, as well as have their own advantages, and then overall they would be more intelligent than humans, the singularity is where technology sort of takes off and gets beyond our immediate control. Although what I said previously about the objective function allows us to retain some kind of control. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so what is going to take us to the singularity? Well, two things are going to take us to the singularity. One is we have to find a way to instill analogical reasoning and associative memory into computers. That would be the first thing. But the other thing is there needs to be some raw material for all of that. What is our intuition based on? It's based on real world experience. And how do we put that into a machine? Well, robotics would be the obvious way. So we think of AI as something which propels robotics, but now we also need to think about the other way around, that robotics is going to help promote the advancement of AI.
No, absolutely fascinating. Now, Mark, as we are getting ready to head here into 2023, what do the next 12 months look like for you?
Well, our big projects that we're working on right now are on data access policy, which is going to be a major game changer for the Space Force. We're going to be opening the gates to folks in their mission pursuits in ways that have not been possible before. And then also observability. We are working with industry in new ways to ensure that everything that they build is something that we can see into, all the way down to the bare metal, as I like to say. And I think those things are really going to unleash the capabilities of the Space Force.
Fantastic. Now, I always end the podcast episode on the same question every single week. We've spoken about so much. I mean, it's been a really fascinating conversation for sure. But what is the one big takeaway you would love our listeners to really bring from this conversation today?
Well, I think everyone appreciates at this point the importance of data science and data management, but there's a lot of uncertainty around how do you actually proceed? What are we supposed to do to tap into all that potential? And so the message that I like to convey for people to keep in mind is that we need to look at the latest and the best methodologies and best practices for data management. And that's something that I call next generation data management. And it's the way that we do data management in the Space Force.
Amazing. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. And I look forward to catching up with you real soon.
All right. My pleasure, Catherine.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast episode. Do be sure to subscribe and follow the Business of Data podcast wherever you're currently listening to ensure you're always first in line to the latest episode. We'd also appreciate your review as well. So if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving us a review. And as always, find us on socials as well as heading over to the Business of Data platform for more forms of great content, including articles, blogs, and video. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and we'll see you real soon.
Are you wanting to meet with other senior executives in the data and analytics space? In an environment that is created for connection and inspiration? Then why not join one of our in-person conferences? We have events all over the world, and you can find out the ones closest to you by visiting CoriniumIntelligence.com/